Good morning and welcome to Jonesy, the show that brings you conversations with some of the most interesting people in the world of books, podcasts, radio, theater, music, and humor, guaranteed to entertain and enlighten. I'm the host of Jonesy, Ken Jones, no relation by the way. On today's show, we pay tribute to perhaps Oregon's greatest writer, Ursula K. Le Guin. I'm sure Ken Kesey would have loved to arm wrestle her for the title, but I think he'd lose. Ursula was not only a brilliant and prolific author, but an activist for the environment and equal rights, and a humanitarian loved by pretty much everyone in the Portland, Pacific Northwest, and international literary community, with the possible exception of Jeff Bezos. To honor Ursula, we'll be focusing on the new book, Dispatches from Inaris, Tales in Tribute to Ursula K. Le Guin from Portland's Forest Avenue Press, with our guests Susan DeFreitas, the book's editor, and David Naiman, who wrote the foreword. Susan is an author, editor, and book coach dedicated to telling stories that matter and helping others do the same. Her novel, Hot Season, won a Gold Ippy Award for Best Fiction of the Mountain West. The Oregonian named Susan one of 25 Oregon authors every Oregonian must read, alongside writers like Cheryl Strayed, Chuck Palahniuk, Willie Vlauten, and of course, Ursula herself. Susan's work has appeared in the Writer's Chronicle, the Huffington Post, the Utney Reader, Story Magazine, Daily Science Fiction, and Portland Monthly, among others, and she was also a contributor to the Portland-centric story anthology, City of Weird. David Naiman hosts the popular literary podcast Between the Covers, which The Guardian named one of the best book podcasts and most recently listed as one of five podcasts that will teach you how to write. He co-authored the book Ursula K. Le Guin Conversations on Writing from Portland's Tin House Books, which collects material from his interviews with Ursula over the years. David was a KBOO radio colleague of mine and taught me just about everything I know about doing book interviews, but please don't hold that against him. In the words of another wonderful Portland-based writer, Kimberly Kim Parsons, Dispatches from Inaris is what happens when a bunch of brilliant writers come together to pay tribute to a singular literary giant. This polyphony of voices from real and imagined worlds is timely, audacious, and teeming with style. Before we get started, just a reminder that we're currently in the middle of our end-of-year membership drive at KBOO Community Radio. We're trying to raise $45,000 by December 31st. Since we get about 80% of our funding from our members, listeners like you, we need your help. You can support programs like this and independent media by becoming a member today, and if you donate right now, your contribution will be matched dollar for dollar up to $10,000 thanks to the generous support of the Ronnie S. LaCroute Fund of the Oregon Community Foundation. You can give online at kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Please join us now for our conversation with Susan and David, which is already in progress. Susan and David, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Now, Dispatches from Inaris is a tribute to Ursula Le Guin. I'd like to start by asking you both about Ursula herself and her influence on you. First, you, Susan. In the book's introduction, you write of how important she became to you when you first moved to Portland, both through her books and through the landscapes of the Pacific Northwest that you shared with her, Harney County, the Wallowa Mountains, the Steens Mountain. In your recent Powell's book launch, you said this connection might have begun even earlier, back in your mother's womb.
That's pretty early, isn't it?
Yeah. Yes.
one of the things I've shared elsewhere is that I first encountered the Earthsea books in my parents' home library. And, you know, you may be familiar, if you're of a certain age, with these sort of book of the month clubs that used to exist, you know, in the 80s. And they had them for albums as well as books. You know, when you joined the club, you could pick out 20 fantastic titles for a penny a piece. And then the only hook was that they would send you a new title each month. And you, if you didn't want to pay the full price for it, you had to send the book or album back. Well, my parents had joined the fantasy and science fiction book club this way. And there were many, many titles that they either loved and wanted to keep or simply didn't have the time and space to remember to send them back. And so I grew up with a whole shelf of fantastic science fiction and fantasy. And I was very struck by A Wizard of Earthsea, reading it as a tween, as many young people are, because it's the story, you know, the story of Ged in the first book is the story of this brilliant young person who has to overcome his own arrogance and confront his shadow. And it's a story that's tailor-made, I think, for precociously, you know, smart young person who's reading above their grade level, you know, and reading this book maybe at 11 or 12. And I love the books that followed as well, but there were so many fantastic books on that bookshelf. There was Patricia MacKillop, and there was C.J. Cherry, and there was Stanislaw Lem, and Ray Bradbury, and Stephen R. Donaldson, and the list goes on and on, right? So I understood that Le Guin was a fantastic writer, but I didn't quite understand the full range of her work until I moved to Portland in 2009. And, you know, she has had a larger than life sort of legendary presence about town. And later I would hear the founder of Fish Trap, a literary organization in Eastern Oregon, call her quite simply the intellectual leader of our state. And you could feel that there. And so I thought, well, now is the time to acquaint myself with more of her work. And I was just blown away by the range between her science fiction set in the Haynish universe, all her various fantasy novels, and the sheer quality and emotional power consistently across these books. And so I absolutely fell in love with her work. She became my favorite writer, but it was only later when I talked with my mother that I found out that she had actually been reading those Earthsea books when she was pregnant with me. So in a way you could say Le Guin has been with me my whole life.
That's a great story. Now, David, you interviewed Ursula several times for Between the Covers and collected some of that material in the 2018 book, Ursula K. Le Guin, Conversations on Writing. It seems there was a mutual connection right from the start. She wrote in that book's introduction, "The good interview is like a bad mitten rally. You know, right away, the two of you can keep that birdie in the air and all you have to do is watch it fly." What was it like talking with her and working with her on the Conversations book?
Well, it's interesting that I guess like Susan, my first exposure was Earthsea, but almost all my interactions with Ursula for the show were about things that were marginal to her reputation in the world. They weren't marginal to her, but they weren't the most known aspects of her. And some of the things were actually pretty unknown. So our focus on her poetry and her translations, on her essay writing and literary criticism. And then on our first conversation with talking about craft of writing, grammar, syntax, discovering moral and political questions on the level of the sentence. And I think the reason why we hit it off from the beginning is I think there was both for her an excitement and a relief that I wasn't asking her to pontificate on the status of the future of science fiction, but instead we were grappling over pronouns and sentence length, talking about the difference between telling a story and writing a poem. And what was really fascinating about it was that even when we were staying at that level, I felt like it really exposed a lot of the origins of what we so love about her in the books that she's most well known for. So there was this holographic sort of microcosm, macrocosm relationship that I think happened. And I also, just to add on to something that Susan said about her larger than life presence in the world, that I think speaks to Susan's ingenious notion of collecting writings by writers in Portland under the premise that perhaps writers who share her town or her bioregion are both influenced by her and may have influenced her. and that bringing them together collectively might speak to something about Ursula, not just about them, is that I think she, a lot of what she did in the world wasn't larger than life, or a lot of the important stuff that she was doing wasn't larger than life in the sense that it was quite quiet and she was building ecosystems. So her support of the community radio station, not the most prominent radio station in Oregon, but aligning with her ethos and her politics, or her work at Fish Trap, or her teaching at the Malheur Field Station, or her being one of the founders of the prototype for literary arts. She was doing all of this pretty quietly, supporting and seeding very small micro presses, anarchist and feminist presses that were outside of New York City. These are things she wasn't super well known for. But I think just like the grammar and just like the poetry and just like the translations, I think this was the material from which grew these larger works and her larger than life reputation, even though it was not really spoken about.
I think you call that an imaginative composting of taking all these experiences and kind of working it into her fiction.
Well, that's what she mentioned, this notion from Gary Snyder, which I mentioned in the foreword, of all these ways that you're exposed to things and how you have to have patience and allow them to compost and become soil. Yeah, so I mean, really the what I wanted to do with the foreword for the book was, because it felt so obvious to me, this this clever connection of gathering writers in Portland and what could they say about Ursula, is I wanted to step back three or four steps and be skeptical of the connection and then work my way back to it. So is this real? Can Portland writers really speak to what Ursula did and what her influence is? And is Portland really that important to, or is the West Coast that important to Ursula's writing when so much of it is taking place in other imagined places?
And that, as you you mentioned in the foreword, is the premise behind the book is this influence on Northwest writers and probably Northwest readers. Now, Susan, in your introduction to the book, you quote Ursula's essay, Disappearing Grandmothers, and that's on the ways in which women writers are erased from the literary canon. You mentioned C.J. Cherry. She's a good example. I think Grace Paley is another very good example. Why isn't she up there with Saul Bellows and Philip Ross of the world? Here's the quote, denigration, omission, an exception during a writer's lifetime, or preparations for her disappearance after her death. And you write that Dispatches from Anaris is a further argument to help assure Ursula's place in the canon. Quoting you, one way of insisting upon, one way of saying, look at the world she left us. That seems to be one of your prime objectives with the book, too.
Absolutely. I took those words, which I first heard her speak on in conversation with David Naiman on in the course of an interview. I was walking around in Eastern Oregon, yeah, during part of my time with Fish Trap. You know, I heard those words and they raised the hair on the back of my neck. You know, in the wake of her recent death, I took it as a challenge. I took those words as a strong reminder from one of my elders about one of the truths of the world, from a feminist elder, reminding me of one of the truths of the world that, of course, I would just as soon, so many of us would just as soon forget that that is true. But no matter what the progress is that we've made, that we can celebrate, that we can feel good about, that process of erasure of women's intellectual achievements and history is ongoing. It is insidious. It is systemic, right? And in order to keep that from happening, it's not enough just to have an ideal of wanting it not to happen. It's like being anti-racist. You must do something. You must actively pit yourself against this erasure. And to me, this was the hill I was going to die on, really. You know, this is my favorite writer. I thought at some point, when she passed, that maybe I would go back to school and do a PhD just so I could add one academic brick to the wall, holding back the flood trying that would come, I knew, to try to wash her legacy away. But then there came a moment of truth with myself where I was like, Susan, you hate academia. Why would you do that? Like I chose creative writing rather than, literature, for my master's degree, for my undergraduate degree. I can do academia, but I hate it the whole time. I'm a creative writer, but I am also an editor, and I have been an editor for close to 15 years now. And it's one way of blending my creative vision, that I have as a writer, as a creative writer myself, with this act of literary citizenship that I knew I wanted to make on behalf of the great lady. And then also supporting these other voices, in a sort of curation. And I'm also a child of the 80s and 90s, and we used to make these artifacts, boys and girls, called mixtapes. And I was an obsessive mixtape maker. I'd replay the transition from one song to the next over and over until the beat was just exactly right, until there was a tonal, correspondence where there was like something in the lyrics that echoed or counterpointed each other. And that's exactly what I did with this anthology. And it was one of the great joys of my life to create this document.
And I think it actually will turn out to be a bigger brick in that wall than a PhD thesis.
I certainly hope so.
Much wider audience. Now, David, your foreword provides incredible context for the collection with the profile of Ursula and her concerns, her issues. You talk about the importance she placed on the imaginary as a component of realism, and imagination is so central to the stories in this book, in this tribute to her. You quote her as saying, "Children know perfectly well that unicorns aren't real, but they also know that books about unicorns, if they're good books, are true books." How did she view the imaginary and her sci-fi and fantasy books as a path to the truth? She kind of also embraced her role as a genre writer, though she was sometimes segregated from writers of so-called literary fiction.
Well, she definitely, unlike, say, Margaret Atwood, felt proud to be in what was in the so-called denigrated genre of science fiction and fantasy,
Yes.
and fought the genre wars from within, while also being very fiercely putting forth that she didn't just write science fiction and fantasy. She also wrote novels and essay collections and poetry and children's books that were not in that genre. But when she was writing from that genre or critiquing others who were either writing in that genre or visiting the genre but not respecting its history, she was very supportive of it as worthy of the name literature as anything in realist fiction. But I also think ultimately the question is anything realistic that doesn't include the imaginative?
I would add this too, because oh my gosh, that's such an incredible point. And now I'm recalling again the conversations that I've listened to between you, David, and Ursula on this very subject. I recently read Always Coming Home. And this is one of her great seminal and most neglected works. There's just a point that she often made. And that book takes the future. It is her imagined idea of a future, right? A future people living in the Napa Valley of California after some various earth changes have taken place. And at first, it feels like you're in some version of a past, right? So people with material culture based in pottery and weaving and ritual and ceremony and live in group houses. But then you get intimations that this is actually a post-fall, like there are poisoned areas. There's a limited use of technology, right? And that feels like our present or like the future. And what struck me so much, in connection to what you were just saying about the uses of the imagination, is that I think one of the themes that I pick up from her expository writing, from her essays, is that she was challenging us to actually use the imagination. She had the sense that our imagination as a culture was stuck in a capitalist mindset of growth, 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 progress, at any cost, and that we were kind of stunted in what we could actually imagine about our future. So I think in that way, she, in drawing upon, in lots of ways, Native American cultural life ways, traditional life ways of indigenous people around the planet, but then carrying them into the future and saying, look, if this sounds new to you, if this is not like anything you have ever imagined about the future, then what's wrong with your imagination? Who is telling you what you can imagine? Because there's nothing impossible about this at all. And when we think of like post-apocalyptic literature, dystopian literature, doesn't it feel so much like we're stuck in that imaginative rut? Like we can't imagine our way forward from where we are now. She could. And that, I think, is one of the most powerful uses of the imagination.
I was listening to a podcast you did recently, I think, Susan, and you were talking that you were working currently on a collection of fairy tales and how these stories, and I think stories about unicorns would be included in that category, how they help prepare children for, and I think, well, I'm quoting you here, the dark truth of human existence. So it's a kind of way of educating in a way that's not dogmatic. That the imaginary fairy tales, speculative fiction, fantasy, sci-fi.
Yeah, well, it's a big tent, right? From like that includes both science fiction and fantasy and folktale. But I would say in connection to what you just said and what you're bringing up about that conversation is that we disregard the stories handed down to us from deep our deepest history at our peril. Just like we undermine the ecosystems that support us at our peril, because these are beautifully honed, bits of intelligence, a genetic or story-wise, they survived for a reason, and that's because they were adaptive. And so I think those stories from deep time, from our folktale past, from mythology, there are in kind of irreducible truths at their core that continue to resonate. And again, find our own ways to do different things with them, adapt them to the moment that we are now, but don't dismiss them as the stuff of the nursery, as if there is no intelligence or wisdom there for all people through all time.
Or whitewash them like Disney cartoons do with
Right.
some of these fairy tales or Aesop's fables even. Now, David, in your foreword, you explain the twinning in the book's title, "Dispatches from an Heiress of Portland" and Le Guin's "An Heiress," which is a planet in her book, "The Dispossessed." I bring this up because Susan was just talking about the importance of utopian fiction, in addition to dystopian. Le Guin, I guess, referred to her fictional planet as an ambiguous utopia. Can you give us a little bit of background on an Heiress in The Dispossessed and what you think she means by that ambiguous utopia and how that applies to Portland?
Well, I mean, I wonder whether it's fair to call her an utopian writer because I feel like there's always the suggestion of livable futures, which I think is why people think of her as a utopian writer, but there's always the suggestions and the corruptions with simultaneously happening. Like it feels like you can see both paths often in her work. Like I think what Susan was describing with Always Coming Home. But I do think there's an utopian streak in the sense that she's trying to imagine into a future that we could actually live. it doesn't mean that she's painting a utopia with rose-colored glasses, I guess, is how I'd say it. So she called it an ambiguous utopia. And I quote in the foreword Joe Walton, who said, "Anaris could so easily be irritatingly perfect, but it isn't. But it isn't. There are droughts and famines, petty bureaucrats, and growing centralization of power." And Samuel Delaney also suggests that both Anaris, which is the moon, and Urus, the planet, are ambiguous utopias. They both have a self-regard of themselves as utopian places. And I think that really speaks to something about Portland, both the way it was, I think, once a moon rather than a planet on the West Coast, and much of the culture that thrived was sort of being, relatively speaking, more off of the grid than Seattle and San Francisco and Vancouver and LA. And it went through this period where I think the only way Portland put itself forward was self-congratulatory and in this sort of come here and just rediscover and reinvent yourself without the shadow side of that. And I think we've seen in the last, I don't know, 5 years, the complete flip side of that. The history of Portland, obviously, like everywhere, stolen land, but also racial exclusion, lash laws, redlining, a really horrific past at the same time as some of these other elements of the city, this robust anti-authoritarian streak, tradition of radical politics and collective organizing, many inspiring environmental actions in defense of the earth. And I think her ambiguous utopias sort of, instead of trying to collapse things one way or the other in any given place, I think we see both of those things simultaneously, suggestions of both where we've been and where we could go. Might be the way I would put it. I do think that it's an apt comparison. If we think of Anaris not as an utopia, then I think Portland is an apt comparison to Anaris in that regard.
No, it's such a perfect analogy. Susan, was that what you had in mind with the title, comparing Portland, our city of weird, with Anaris?
What? 100%. 100%. You know, that was in the idea from the very beginning with this anthology. It wasn't something I came to later, you know, but part of it is that Anaris, you know, is a moon. And so it looks back, it's the anarchist moon. There was a rebellion on the planet Urus. And rather than give, I guess, the anarchists their own political party or some type of power in that way, Urus in essence said, we will give you the moon and you can do what you want there, right? And so, you know, yeah, the dispossessed is happening a generation later when they're making diplomatic contact for the first time. But part of it is that, you know, and I am a person who has been part of in environmental activism, kind of people trying to build solutions at the margins and both interrogate and block the machine. I grew up in a back to the land community. So, you know, in the, where I fall, you know, politically is both on the block further damage from happening and build the alternative. That's where I lie. And so that's part of what, you know, always made Portland feel like home to me, you know, because there are a lot of people involved with those endeavors. But that is also when the anarchists are exiled to Anaris, it's a little different to have to build your own society based on your own ideals than it is to simply try to block the machine with protest, with no. So the people of Anaris have that challenge, and they see the problems of human nature, the problems of bureaucracy, the things that arise even in their world of people dedicated to the cause. But they are also a moon looking back at a planet, a capitalist planet. And so they have a perspective on that dominant culture that, say, nobody actually on the surface of that planet could actually have, you know, metaphorically speaking, about their systems of government and their norms on that greater capitalistic planet. So all these things felt to me a little like Portland.
Yes. Yeah. It's just a beautiful analogy and a perfect title. I wanted to, of course, focus on Ursula here, but the book itself, I think 31 stories, just incredible stories. One of my favorites in the book, and this is the only exception I'll make about talking about an individual story in the conversation, because it not only was what you called world-class speculative fiction, but it also is very relevant right now with what's happening in the Supreme Court with the possibility of overturning Roe v. Wade, certainly making it much more difficult for women to get abortions. The story's called The Night Bazaar of Women Becoming Reptiles by Rachel K. Jones, no relation. In the introduction, you write that this story touches on gender oppression and a woman's right to choose. And it does it in such a beautiful and powerful way and such an imaginative way that I think Ursula would love it. Fantasy getting to the truth here. I wondered if you could talk, Susan, a little bit about that story, maybe in the light of this quote from Ursula. Who teaches us to be human, what to fear, what to love? Children learn genderless lessons from women, gendered from men. Fathers teach children sex roles, how to be manly and womanlike. Social and moral change comes from women teaching their children to adapt. And this story is definitely one of adaptation. Spoiler alert.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a powerful story. And the thing that struck me as very Le Guinian about it is that the norms around gender, sex, love, and reproduction in the world of Rachel's story are utterly and completely different from our own. It is assumed that, yeah, a woman will have a night side lover and a sun side lover. And, you know, a family with, I believe, both of them. And, you know, this is what a family is. This is the equivalent of children need both parents. You have to have all four of these five in every family, right? And of course, you must have both a lover of your own gender and of the opposite gender. Like, it would be unthinkable to have anything else, right? And of course, your two lives shall remain separate and never shall they meet. But the protagonist of this story doesn't want a family. She doesn't want all that. She wants outside of the city itself. And there's this magical conceit in this story that if you eat the eggs of a reptile, you know, you will be transformed into a reptile yourself. And that is the only way that you can leave the city, which is an oasis in a burning desert. And there's so many parallels to so many, you know, elements of identity, you know, gender identity, finding an identity outside of the rigid dictates of gender within the city. Deciding whether, as a woman, not wanting to have children and how that's viewed in our society. There are all these ways that the norm is like the only oasis in a burning desert. And if you have the temerity to leave it, you are putting yourself in grave danger. But there is a transformation. There is a possible transformation that can allow you to take on a different identity, a different body even. You know, so hopefully, just as I'm spinning a little bit of this tale for your listeners, they can see all the layers of metaphor, you know, around very complex issues of gender identity and sexual orientation and reproductive rights, all stacking up in this astounding way that they can in great speculative fiction in such a concise and elegant way.
I also wanted to add something to what Susan just said so well. is that there's another element to this story that I think speaks both to other stories in the collection, but also to concerns of Ursula's at large. So this notion that you can eat an egg and then become, if you're a woman and you eat a reptile's egg, you can become a reptile and potentially escape the normative oasis. It's this troubling of, it's not just escaping norms of gender, it's also escaping norms of species. And one of her favorite books was Sword in the Stone. And in that book, the way Merlin trains Arthur to become a king is by transforming him into a rock, into an owl, into all these things. Like, how can he learn to become his destiny? And in a paradoxical way, it's by inhabiting the position of otherness. And in this case, the otherness of other non-human creatures. And so when the protagonist in this story is talking to one of her lovers and saying, I eat these eggs and nothing happens for me, where it's happening seemingly for everybody else, she says, you cannot become what you already are. And to me, that sort of feels like that's speaking to something that I think Ursula is also saying. I mean, in a sense, the ways in which we do have fellow feeling that we try to suppress or deny with creatures across the species divide, for instance. And there are other stories in this collection that also deal with non-human animal, well, not just animal, but non-human intelligence in a way that reflects back on the human.
Oh, it's just a brilliant job of world building. I mean, a lot of the stories in the book are, but this one just struck me in particular. And maybe Rachel K. Jones was channeling Ursula when she was writing the story. Now, back to the abortion part of it. Ursula herself had an abortion when she was a college student at Radcliffe. I think that was the late 40s, early 50s. She writes about this in her essay, What It Was Like. And David, you actually discussed this with her in your conversations book in the nonfiction section. So I'd like to close with an excerpt from a speech she gave to NARAL, that's the National Abortion Rights Action League. I think the speech was in 2012 when she was asked what it was like before Roe v. Wade, and she gives this very personal opinion. Susan, would you read that for us? I think it's just a good way to close, and you're the person to do it.
Absolutely. And, you know, just before I do, I just want to add real briefly, this is a woman of genius, the author of some 68 works of fiction of what I consider to be towering genius. She had this abortion before she'd written a single one of them. Now imagine what might have been taken from her and taken from us had she not been allowed to have that abortion. What was it like in the dark ages when abortion was a crime? For the girl whose dad couldn't borrow cash as my dad could? What was it like for the girl who couldn't even tell her dad because he would go crazy with shame and rage? Who couldn't tell her mother? Who had to go alone to that filthy room and put herself, body and soul, into the hands of a professional criminal? Because that is what every doctor who did an abortion was, whether he was an extortionist or an idealist. You know what it was like for her. You and I know. That is why we are here. We are not going back to the dark ages. We are not going to let anybody in this country have that kind of power over any girl or woman. There are great powers outside the government and in it trying to legislate the return of darkness. We are not great powers, but we are the light. Nobody can put us out. May all of you shine very bright and steady today and always.
Susan, thank you. Thank you, David, and thank you, Ursula.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ken.
Well, that's all for this episode of Jonesy here on KABU Community Radio. If you missed any part of the show, would like to hear the longer, unexpurgated version, the director's cut, you might call it, if we had a director, you could listen anytime, on demand, at kboo.fm/program/Jonesy, Jonesy, or just search for it on the KABU website. Before we head out the door, a big thank you to our guests today, Susan DeFreitas, editor of the new book Dispatches from Inaris, Tales in Tribute to Ursula K. Le Guin from Portland's Forest Avenue Press, and David Naiman, who wrote the book's foreword and co-authored the book Ursula K. Le Guin, Conversations on Writing from Portland's Tin House Books. Just a reminder that we're currently in the middle of our end-of-year membership drive at KABU. We're trying to raise $45,000 by December 31st. Since we get about 80% of our funding from our members, listeners like you, we need your help. You can support programs like this and independent media by becoming a member today. And if you donate right now, your contribution will be matched dollar for dollar up to $10,000 thanks to the generous support of the Ronnie S. LaCroute Fund of the Oregon Community Foundation. You can give online at kabu.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. All of us here at the station, even Jonesy himself, thank you for that. Jonesy comes to you every other week on the second and fourth Thursdays of the month from 11 to 11:30 a.m. Tune in for our next show on Thursday, December 23rd at 11 a.m. We'll be celebrating Christmas a little early with Portland Story Theater's Lynn Duddy and Lawrence Howard telling us their own holiday tales. I'm your host, Ken Jones, no relation, saying, we are not great powers, but we are the light. Nobody can put us out. May all of you shine very bright and steady today and always. Ursula K. Le Guin, 1929 to 2018.